Welcome to Women Worth Knowing, the radio program and podcast hosted by Cheryl Broderson and Robin Jones Gunn.
Hello there, listeners. We're so glad that you're tuning in today. Unfortunately, Robin could not be in the studio today, but I have a guest that I'm really excited about. I have Pam Clark, who has a ministry that she does with, Pam, what's the lady you do the ministry with?
Susan Owade. Yes.
That's it. And it's called Protect Our Daughters. And we're going to talk about that ministry throughout the program. But I want you to get to know Pam. Now, Pam came highly recommended. I think that we got like five letters from you listeners saying, please have Pam. And so I want you to know that we listened and that we've got Pam in studio. And you're right. The more we read her little bio that she gave us, the more excited we got. In fact, Robin is very sad to be missing today because she was really looking forward to this. But Pam, I think your story begins as a child. So can you tell us a little bit? I mean, because just reading this about your father being involved with the Red Cross. Mm-hmm. So how did that come to be, and what was life like growing up with that type of, you know, father?
Thank you. Yes. And first, I want to thank you and Robin for inviting me and having me. It's an honor, and I'm excited to be here with you. And sure, I grew up in a family with seven kids. I'm the sixth of seven.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. And when I was 8 months old, my father joined the Red Cross. And he worked in the area of the Red Cross that supports military community. Mm-hmm. So we moved to Panama when I was 8 months old. And we lived there for 3.5 years and then came back to the States. Moving was just part of life. Mm-hmm. When I was 9 years old, we moved to England and lived there for not quite a year and then moved on to Berlin. And wow. That was just before the Berlin Wall was built.
That is crazy. Yeah. So you were on then the east side? Or the west side?
West.
Okay,
yes.
West side.
Yes.
Which is safer.
Yes. And at that point, the Berlin Wall had not happened yet.
Wow.
My father came in as the director for the American Red Cross in Germany. Mm-hmm. And so we were there. I think we moved there in 61.
Wow.
I was 10.
Wow.
And within that first year, year and a half, the wall was proclaimed. Mm. So that had a pretty profound impact on me. I was so fortunate that mm-hmm. I had a teacher in school who took us all over Berlin.
Wow.
He really encouraged his class, all mm-hmm. of us, to experience and be aware of the history that we were living in. Mm-hmm. And so we did get to see a lot. And then another thing that just was really a blessing and an impact in my life is that my father worked in the military headquarters. Mm-hmm. That's where the Red Cross office was. And a German man wandered in one day and just asked if any of the men working there had a daughter of an approximate age that would be willing and interested to come and stay with them for a week or two, that they had a daughter of a similar age that really wanted to practice her English and wanted to get to know an American girl. So my father came home and told me about that, and I said, sure. Yes. Mm-hmm. And so I lived with that family for about a week mm-hmm. and got to hear their story and be a part of their life.
Wow.
Which was pretty profound. Mm-hmm. What they shared with me is that when the wall was proclaimed, mm-hmm. Businesses that were in the path of where the wall was being planned for were seized, were bricked through, and theirs, they had a business where that happened. And they also shared with me that they had a daughter that was a bit older mm-hmm. than the one I was getting to know, who was just talking with one of the guards. And all along the wall, there was barbed wire, but also glass all along the top of the wall. And the guards that were along the top had chains around their waists.
Oh, my goodness.
So that they could not jump. Because at that point, there were many, many attempted running away.
Right.
Jumping over the wall.
Right. And yes.
So their daughter was speaking with this guard, and she was shot and killed just for doing that.
No.
Yeah. So these are, you know, just things that had a pretty profound impact on me. And having grown up in different cultures,
mm-hmm.
and it continued because we lived in Munich after we were mm-hmm. in Berlin for a few years. I just developed a love and a fascination with different cultures
mm-hmm.
and different people groups. And so I just gravitated toward that.
Mm-hmm.
And just another little story is that I was out with a friend in a playground, and a German woman heard us talking in English. And she came up to me and started screaming at me in German and blaming me for the war, for persecution. At that point in my life, I really even didn't have a concept of Jewish people or what all had happened
mm-hmm.
to that people group. So I was kind of baffled. And
how old are you at this point?
I'm 10.
10. Oh, 10, my goodness. Right.
You know, and
yes.
So, again, just kind of seeing the hurt,
mm-hmm.
seeing the pain, seeing the anger, and seeing bullies, really. One of the things that also was an early profound experience for me is when we moved from England, we took the ferry to Germany. And then when we got to Germany, we drove from the port to Berlin. And that meant driving through East Berlin, the East Germany.
Oh, wow.
And not East Berlin, but East Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall us having to stop every so many kilometers where my parents would be required to show their documents. They'd have to get out of the car. Guards would come and check everything. And also as we were driving, which was through almost like forests, small roads,
mm-hmm.
there were soldiers with Uzis.
Oh, my goodness.
Along, you know, stationed along the side of the road every so often. And so just seeing that, experiencing mm-hmm. that.
Wow.
And then living in Berlin, we started off being in a house that was part of the military community. And then because our family was big, we were given the opportunity to move what's called on the economy,
mm-hmm.
which is out in the community, in a house that had been a Nazi officer's house.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And it was just a few blocks away from Freie Universität, which was the big university in Berlin, still there. And so we lived at this house that was two stories, but also had a basement. The basement had a bomb shelter.
Wow.
And then it had an attic.
That had to be fascinating for children.
It was. Mm-hmm. It was fascinating. And really, the basement and even the bomb shelter was like our playground.
Yes.
You know, it was fascinating. There's a little safe in the middle of the, you know, bomb shelter. It was just very impacting.
Mm-hmm.
And just living there and getting to know people. And it just ended up that I spoke German probably the best in my family. And at the time, I was the only girl at home.
Okay.
So there were three girls and four brothers.
Okay.
And our oldest sister passed away about 20, 25 years ago. So, but my next sister, who was just out of high school, was going to school in Switzerland.
Wow.
And so it was my four brothers and me living at home with mom and dad. And my father, as the Red Cross director, participated in, got very involved in a situation where a young girl had been left by her mom with her grandparents. They were German, but the mom had met and married an American GI who then was stationed back in the States. Mm. And so Beate was living with her grandparents. I think she was about three when this happened. And the parents' thought was that they would send for Beate once they were established. And in the meantime, the wall was declared. And so when they reached out to try to do that, they were told, no, you know, no one leaves.
Wow.
No one was allowed to leave East Berlin. In fact, it was, and you may already know this, but the day that the wall was proclaimed or declared, anyone that was on the east side could not leave.
Mm-hmm.
So people who maybe the husband, the wife just went to work, they can no longer go home. You know, they are there. And so for Beate, she's living with her grandparents. The new father contacted the American Red Cross and asked, is there anything you can help us with? And my understanding is that the American Red Cross or the German Red Cross collaborated and were able to convince the East German government that it would be to their benefit.
Yes.
To let this little girl go. And so my father met the little girl at Checkpoint Charlie.
Wow.
And then brought her to our house. And, you know, in consideration of all the protocol, she had to have shots and medical evaluations. And she also didn't have hardly any clothing or things.
Mm-hmm.
So she stayed with us for close to a week.
Wow.
And me being the only girl and speaking German the most in my family, she just, like, attached herself to me, and she would follow me around and play with me and cry when I left to go to school. And it was huge, huge, you know, impact. In that situation, in that time, that story was it was an international story. It was Life magazine was following it. It was on the news, in the media, and during that time, I walked into a Konditori, which is like a pastry candy shop in Germany, near our home, to get something, and I looked up at the newspapers there on the wall, on a rack, and the whole front page is a picture of my father and this little girl.
Oh, my goodness.
And I looked up and I looked at the shopkeeper and I said, das ist mein Vati. And she said, oh, schön, schön, you know, and just, you know, just profound and wonderful.
And so proud of your dad, I bet.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, fast forward, I'm in my late teens, early 20s in San Francisco, Golden Gate Park, and the wandering reporter that comes and interviews people with questions and asks, you know, who is your childhood idol?
Oh,
and I said, my dad.
That's so amazing. I love that.
Yeah.
So now, when did you return to the States?
We came back Let's see. It must have been in 63.
Mm-hmm. 63. So you're so different than your peers.
Yes.
There's that phenomena that they're calling second culture kids.
Yeah.
And obviously you had that. But, you know, you're coming back at the height of anti-establishment, hate the government. Mm-hmm. And you're going, you guys, you don't know how good we have it. Would that be a good assessment of kind of?
You know, it's interesting. When we left Europe, we were in Berlin for just over 2 years. Then we moved to Munich for a year. So 4 years of my life. And when we came back to the States, we came by ship. Transatlantic to New York. Mm-hmm. And I recall getting off the ship and wandering through these halls in the dock into New York, and everything is very loud and echoing.
That's right. Yes.
And then, you know, people are
boisterous.
Boisterous, and
everyone yells.
And I'm speaking almost like a combination of German and English. It's like some German words were and still are just part of my vernacular. Mm-hmm. And there's definitely a part of me that feels European. Mm-hmm. You know, I really, that had so much impact on me. So coming back to the States, it was like stunning.
Right.
How different.
Right.
How different it was. And so I think I came back in a way with just a very deep love and appreciation of the culture, the values, the nature, the families living together, multi-generational families living together. Mm-hmm. And then coming back here, it was kind of a culture shock.
Absolutely.
Culture shock.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So now, your family, did they have any type of spirituality or?
That's a great question. My father's mother was very involved in her Methodist church. In fact, that grandfather and grandmother were the first couple married in this Methodist church in Boise, Idaho.
Right.
Collister Methodist Church. And so that was there, but it was not something that my parents really
embraced
or talked about. I, as a child, especially like when we lived in Europe and visiting beautiful cathedrals and churches, and then having the opportunity to hear about and then go to vacation Bible schools.
Oh, I love this.
I hadn't done that before. Mm-hmm. I went to those. I gravitated towards that. And it meant something to me. And so that really was kind of the beginning of my spiritual, even a glimpse of an understanding.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I find it interesting because obviously you were also a spectator, not only of the Berlin Wall going up, but also of the Jesus Revolution. Mm-hmm. I mean, you came back and it actually started in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, I mean, but also you're coming back. I mean, that's the time of Charles Manson. I mean, all of that, like, welcome to the United States, you know?
Yeah. You hit a lot of things right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I for me, coming back and I lived in Europe when Kennedy was shot.
Oh, right.
And I can recall being at a Girl Scout meeting.
Right.
You know, and one of the girls in our troop came running up the stairs and said, you know, President Kennedy's been shot.
Mm.
And I said, that is not a funny joke.
Yeah.
You know, and then realized it was truth. And just even in that time frame and having a teacher that had us write about capital punishment.
Mm-hmm.
And Ruby, Lee Harvey Oswald,
right,
of that's like, what would be the consequence?
Right.
And so those were times for me. And having grown up also in Berlin, where I saw the guards I was describing to you, mm-hmm. I saw the wreaths you know, along the wall. People would leave wreaths where their loved ones had died.
Yeah.
I had a pretty profound sense as a child. So here, you know, 12, 13 years old. My understanding at that point was it's like there are bullies, and that's not the solution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, capital punishment is not the solution.
Mm-hmm.
It's we need to work more on what's underneath that, you know?
That's pretty profound for a young girl.
It was interesting because we had to write a paper about it, and my teacher then pulled me aside and said, you have an understanding, and I have an understanding that most people don't have.
Mm-hmm.
And even for me to hear that as a 12 or 13-year-old was like, you know, it's just kind of how things look to me.
You know, it's interesting because so many of the people I interview and you say, you know, what's the moment of salvation?
Yeah.
And they'll say, well, wait, you can't start there.
Yeah.
You have to start earlier because you see that the Lord is working.
Absolutely.
In all these different ways, because even though your parents didn't fully embrace your grandparents, the Methodism, you had those values.
Yeah.
You still had those values. And I think, too, in the United States, we've got the residual effects and the residual values of Christianity.
Yeah.
And we don't even realize that we treasure love. Yeah. We treasure life.
Yeah.
And that is a fully Christian concept. You don't have that with, you know.
Many other places.
Right. With Hinduism or, you know, with Muslim, Islam, you don't have those values, and you don't have those values in, you know, atheistic countries.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, like you didn't have those values in East Berlin.
Yeah.
Those values were not there. The value of life, it's not there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I find this really, really profound. Mm-hmm. We've got about 2 minutes, so I want to just these last 2 minutes, just talk about what happened when you got back to the United States? You know, kind of let's set the stage for part two.
Okay.
Because part two, we're going to get into how you got saved.
Okay.
And, you know, but, you know, what was going on when you got back for the next couple of years?
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. And I just want to say what you just summarized was beautifully said. So thank you. Yeah. And when we came back to the States, we drove across the country from New York to California, settled in Arizona, and then mid-year, my parents bought a home. And so we were in an area that was highly Hispanic, and I stood out like a sore thumb.
Okay, you know? Because people who are listening to this do not know that you have blonde hair and blue eyes. So let me just say for the record, it's almost a strawberry blonde.
Yes.
So very much stood out. Right?
Yes, yes. You know, and it was more strawberry when I was younger, more kind of golden color. But yeah, and so this, you know, strawberry blonde, blue-eyed, fair hair, freckle-faced girl that speaks in an English-German accent, you know. And so that had a lot of challenges in itself.
Right.
And maybe we can talk more about that.
I would love to.
Yeah.
Because, again, you're entering another culture.
That's right.
And, you know, my aunt was actually, she had the first Four Square Church of Phoenix, Arizona. So, and she had a camp in Williams, Arizona that was for foster children.
Okay.
But also run by the Four Square Church. So they also took church camps too.
Yeah.
So yes, there's so much to that culture that we have so much to talk about.
Yeah.
So if you've enjoyed part one, and I know that I have been fascinated by Pam and by her story and by part one. And I can't wait for part two. So we're going to invite you to come back next week for part two. 2. And in part 2, we're going to talk a little bit more about Pam's life, how she got saved, how she got launched into the ministry, and what that ministry is. So we're inviting all of you, please come back for part 2 with Pam Clark. And oh, there's so much more to come. I just can't wait.
Thank you for listening to Women Worth Knowing with Cheryl Broderson and Robin Jones Gunn. For more information on Cheryl, visit CherylBroderson.com or follow her on Instagram or Facebook. For more information on Robin, visit RobinGunn.com or follow her on Instagram or Facebook. Join us each week for a lively conversation as we explore the lives of well-known and not-so-well-known historical and contemporary Christian women. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode. Make sure you rate us on your podcast app, subscribe, and share it with a friend. Thank you again for listening to Women Worth Knowing with Cheryl Broderson and Robin Jones Gunn.